Hey, all you podcast listeners. Today, Marcus interviews Karen Craigs-Milne, founder of Conscious Equality. This woman is an absolute force to be reckoned with. She has worked with global governments, NGOs, and corporations, and is an internationally recognized expert in her field. Karen is an expert on promoting equity, gender equality, and inclusion on a global scale. She has a unique perspective coming from a multicultural household where inside was full of inclusion and embracing differences, and outside, each member of her family faced different exclusions and biases. You can hear the passion in her voice, and she has a remarkable ability to engage even the most, I'll call them skeptical, of people. She's an activist, she empowers marginalized people to reach their full potential, and she's incredibly skilled at helping others see the value of an inclusive workplace. I don't even know what to say or where to start. Just listening to her chat with Marcus has motivated me to look at ways to be more inclusive at work and the hospital. Sometimes it's so easy to just let things slide, and she reminds us that the effort, when done mindfully and consciously, is totally worth it. I'd like to give a shout out, as usual, to She, spelled SH3, for writing and performing our music, which was also produced by Android Beats. You can check them out on our website. This podcast is sponsored by Femme Apparel. We believe in gender equality and use thought-provoking messaging to bring attention to gender disparity and to challenge the status quo to be more inclusive and equal. And with that, I'll hand you over to Marcus.
About women's rights and environmental, you know, feminist environmentalism or feminist economics. How do I translate that into a job?
Right. And so when you were exposed to that, did it circle back to any of your childhood and your decision to come to Canada and your experiences when you first got here? Like, were you able to relate any
to
of
the
your
work?
Well,
I think the theme that so it's a sub-theme of a bigger theme that's really important to me. And the bigger theme is around inequality in general. And that really does connect to my life story because I grew up in a multicultural home. My mother was Indian, Gujarati. My father was British. He had traveled to Africa in his 20s from England and was a colonialist. So he was part of the British government there in Africa to not only build infrastructure, but to extract resources. And so, you know, there was this very complex life story for each one of them being in a different continent from their original histories. And then, you know, on top of that, my dad had a son with a Kenyan woman, and he was adopted into our family. And so I had a black brother and a brown mother and a white father. And I just became aware very early about how you can feel safe and you can feel like you're complete and whole amongst people who love you. But the second you walk out that door, that changes. And so I became aware of that very quickly, that in any situation that we were in, one of us was always not good enough. We didn't fit in this way. We didn't fit in that way. And it was just something that was always on my mind. And when you take that to a macroeconomic level, you know, that issue of inequality and not being equal to and not being valued the same, it plays out in economics. So you see how Africa, you know, is still trying to come out of the shadows of this reputation of being far behind and of having less to offer and of being just, you know, a source of natural resources. We are so much more than that as a continent. And so when I went into international development, that was kind of like the big thing was like, how do I help reduce this inequality? And when it came to women's rights and feminist work and gender equality, all of that kind of was just one sub path of a bigger passion that I have around equality issues. And so you'll see me talk about conscious equality. You'll see me talk about global equality. Gender equality needs to be part of a much more robust conversation than just women versus men, because that doesn't, you know, there's much more to it.
Yeah. And I would hesitate to even say that we should have the word versus in there, right?
There you go. Yeah.
It's both sides are absolutely responsible for, we'll call it the solution or the path forward. And it's that sort of, you know, battle verbiage, I think, that can sometimes get in the way of an otherwise good intention.
Yes, and you know, it would maybe it wouldn't surprise you, you know, when I started out doing this work around gender equality, I was shocked at how many people were taught or had absorbed or, you know, saw the world in terms of in this binary fashion where it's about one versus another and it's about zero sum and it's about, you know, even white women versus women of color. Like, and a lot of what I do is about trying to heal and bring people together and help them see that, you know, in many ways we have a lot more in common than the differences that we think set us apart. And that includes women and men, right? So like very much like you're saying, when you're looking at gender equality, one of the terms that I use in my training sessions is this notion of instrumentalizing men. And it was huge for me because we would work in different settings and different projects where, you know, men were basically being told by women picketing, like in Yellowknife, this was a project in Yellowknife, women were picketing with government funding to say, stop hitting us, we have rights, you shouldn't be doing this, you know this is wrong. But I knew from my own personal experience that most men know that that is wrong. But if they're doing it anyway, there's something underneath that needs to be addressed. There's the underlying factors. And often when you really get to the root of it with somebody, you take the time to get to know them, you realize that they have been abused, that they have gone through some kind of trauma, that as a man, they were expected to socially not process it, not express it, not show emotion, not cry. So they are impacted by the same system as we are from a socialization perspective. And they have as much to lose and as much to gain as we do. But the conversation is always so focused on what women don't have and how women are disempowered. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. I just think that the way we instrumentalize men in engaging them as one methodology, it really backfires. It actually doesn't help the work.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, as I'm learning more now, going down this path of this company with its mission, it's interesting because that you notice that there's a lot of the issues stem from a lack of love and from a place of insecurity and previous hurt. And it's hard to sometimes remember that when you're seeing what people are saying. And I mean, I'm not putting myself in the same shoes as a woman who's experienced that, but even just the feedback that I've received from men is you're just kind of like, well, like, why are you so offended by this notion? But you know, you start to think a little bit more about it. And obviously there's a lot of underlying issues. So I think you're probably bang on. Societally, we have a lot of work to do in addressing the root causes as opposed to the symptom, right?
And I think there's it's what I call an ecosystem approach. So there's working directly on direct issues that are affecting women. So for example, if a woman is homeless, then creating a homeless shelter will help her. But that alone is not enough because there's a whole systemic process of discrimination behind the scenes that's working that actually puts people at risk of becoming homeless. So we want to work with, you know, what we call the tip of the iceberg that everybody can see, because that's valid work. We also want a systemic approach that deals with all of the different systems behind the scenes that put people at risk in different ways and that create these situations. And we want to work at the level of values and attitudes so that we can get back to this notion of, you know, that we are all human beings, we all deserve dignity, and we all deserve the right to fully realize, you know, what we're able to do with our lives. And it just boggles my mind that, you know, we live in a world where somebody else feels like I'm taking something away from them if I'm trying to express myself, or if I'm trying to walk down the street, or if I'm trying to apply for a board position for some reason. You know, even people who are not involved in that actual scenario have something to say about it. You know, it's just, yeah. And I'm feeling it more and more, right? Because I'm doing a lot of media work. I'm talking on radio, I'm talking on TV, I'm doing a lot of these YouTube. I've realized that the bigger I get in terms of exposure, the more backlash I'm starting to feel and see in writing and otherwise from people. And it's sad because it just tells me that this work really needs to keep happening. So I think it's great that you have this amazing work that you're doing and you're promoting awareness and you're calling people out on your stories. I did that the other day, like, you know, I mean, that's a big part of it, the everyday actions that we take, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people, I think unfortunately in some cases it might be so commonplace that we just kind of fluff it off. But I think it's important that we bring it to the forefront and I don't do it so that people rally around and go after these individuals, but we just need to see this is the motivation. This is why we need to have these conversations, because this behavior happens. It's epidemic. It happens every day, all the time.
It's invisible to us, right? So I just want to talk very briefly about a story that came up yesterday that I spoke to the press about, and it was a Canadian story. So you've got a woman who's being interviewed by a journalist on camera. It's probably her first time ever speaking on camera about a serious issue. And this young, you know, person walks in and interrupts her 5 seconds of having a credible platform to kiss her on the mouth in front of the whole park. And he doesn't even know her. Right? And it's like layers to it. And the thing in my mind is that the reporter reported on, these are young people who don't understand the health risks of not social distancing. And it's like, wait a minute, have you missed the whole conversation around consent here? She didn't even know he was leaning in to kiss her. She was stunned in the moment. And just because she said afterwards, which may have been because she was in front of so many people, just because she said, oh, he's hot, and she giggled and laughed, doesn't mean that she didn't afterwards go, oh my God, what just happened to me? I feel violated. That wasn't right. He didn't ask me, right?
So it was an assault.
It was, yeah. So it's like, even if she said afterwards, yes, the point is it was after the fact. He assumed she'd be okay with it. He didn't take the time to even ask. And the fact that a reporter just stood there and watched it happen, like, he didn't understand his role in terms of bystander intervention. And, you know, now I'm receiving a lot of backlash. It's really interesting. People saying, what's wrong with you? Why do you care? Maybe you don't have a good love life. Like, this isn't about my love life. It's about, you know, us unpacking these moments. It's not about making anyone wrong in this scenario, but to say, this is how invisible it is to us. And, you know, the only way to address that kind of daily microaggression that we experience as women and even men is to talk about these things and say, hey, what is there to learn from this?
That's right. Point it out so that we can understand and see that it's not acceptable.
Yeah.
So how did the idea for your company come to be then? So you found, you know, a passion and a belief and a cause once you started your gender equality work. How did your company idea come about?
So I've been doing equality work for 20 years, and a majority of that time has been focusing specifically on women's rights and gender equality. And I'll always talk about those two as two different things because they're distinct. About 2 years ago, I almost died in a car crash. Actually, it was 3 years ago. It was a random day. You know, I'm just doing my thing, driving on the highway, and my car flips and I'm about to die. And it was ridiculous to see my kids and my husband drive off right in front of me, thinking they didn't even notice that I'm about to go down.
It was
like a Hollywood moment. But it also felt, because I the car rolled, it was so badly damaged, but I was able to get out of it and I survived it without any major injuries. And it, like, to the point where the next day I was driving again, right? Where do you develop that kind of resilience? It's incredible. But that was a turning point for me in my work. And I was actually thinking, like, I've been traveling around the world, I've been working with presidents and prime ministers. I've been doing all of this amazing stuff. I was flying high in terms of success, but it came at a very high cost to my children and my husband, because I was never here. I was busy saving the world. And when I sat on the hospital bed and started thinking, like, what if I die today? What if I have a brain injury or a bleed that I'm not aware of, and I have, like, literally 30 minutes before my lights go out? Like, you know, what has my life been all about? Am I okay with it? And what came back to me was, the only people who will suffer when I'm not here are my 3 children and my husband. And that started like a massive shift for me in what I would call an awakening. It was both a spiritual awakening, but also a change in what I was doing. And I was ready to walk away from all of it. I'm like, instead of saving the world, I need to save my family. I need to save my marriage. I need to save, you know, this is the most important thing. And in the process, I really started to awaken and understand and learn about crystals and tarot card healing and vibration, the importance of vibration and the laws of the universe. And I put this work aside to really focus on my own healing. And then I was like, so what do I do now? Like, where do I go? Do I just read tarot cards, or do I go back to doing the work I was doing? I don't know, because I quit a very, very amazing job in the process. And then I just I meditated on it, and then it hit me. It was like, I need to do equality work, and I need to bring the consciousness that I've learned about into it. And it's, you know, and that's exactly what I'm doing. So the company that I created is called Conscious Equality. And that's for, I would say, at least three different reasons. So one is that I think a lot of the work we do around women's rights, female empowerment, gender equality is very cerebral. So when I talk about cerebral, it means that we're walking around doing training sessions, telling people what they should do. We're not dealing with the heart trauma. We're not dealing with the DNA, multi-generational issues that are, you know, we're not dealing with the human being. And so the work from Conscious Equality is at a much deeper level, and it's much more about, you know, words like love and dignity and, you know, just universal consciousness. And people go, what? People are not awake yet, right? But the other thing about it is that, as I've said already, that, you know, one of the issues with this work is that we have a tendency as human beings to silo things down, to break them down so that they're simple. And in the process, we lose a lot of the richness and texture of what we're doing. And so Conscious Equality is also about breaking some of those silos. So I am not just, I don't just work on gender. I work on gender equality. I work with LGBTQS issues. I work on race. I work on, you know, I work with men. I'm not just all about women's rights. Like, there's so many different types of women. They all have so many different issues. Same with men. So, you know, the Conscious Equality was an attempt for me to break the siloed thinking and the siloed language and say, we need to rise above that approach and really like embrace the complexity of the work that we're doing. And the best way I could think to do that was to just create a new language for it. And then, of course, the last reason is because, and I talk about this sometimes in my trainings, is people think that good intentions are enough, that they validate what we're doing. But you know, I can tell you story after story after story where somebody was trying to do something good, but they created more harm in the process because they didn't know what they were doing. And this work is about changing people's lives. We literally change people's lives. Like, there was a project in Ghana that I went into that our organization was funding. And the goal was, through microfinance, we're going to empower women. We're going to help them raise income in their households because they don't have income right now, which impacts their rights and their decision-making. So if we get them to have $100 each through the microfinance project, money that's theirs that they can own, they can make better decisions, they can reinvest in their kids, etc. But what actually ended up happening, even though the intention was good, was that we created a situation where women were earning more money, but they were also seeing higher rates of divorce, higher rates of gender-based violence, higher rates of suicide, because we went in there working only with women. We didn't acknowledge the power dynamics in the household. We didn't work with the men and get their buy-in. We completely set one group up against the other, and we actually caused a lot of harm. And at the end of the day, when we write back to the donors, we say, oh, well, it was a fantastic project because 300 women made $100 each. We don't even look to ask, where did we hurt people in the process? So for me, Conscious Equality is about being conscious that this work is like a web, and you cannot impact this person here without impacting this person here. And you have to map that out, and you have to find ways to mitigate the risks that are involved with the change you're trying to create. That's a long answer, but very
have you found through your career and in your work that men are not as often brought into the conversation as they should be?
Yeah. And if they are, they're not necessarily engaged in a way that's constructive. There's a major, major, not just one, there's more than one NGO that's doing really important work around women's rights and girls' rights. And, you know, their whole thing was focused on one group of people. And it's like, that's great, but I'm telling you right away that you're going to have a whole other group of people saying, you know, what about us? It's reverse discrimination, which is, the affirmative action is important and it's needed, but it needs to be contextualized. And if you only do affirmative action and you don't set it up right, you end up creating backlash. And that's exactly what happens in communities overseas. It happens here. It happens everywhere. And men are part of the solution. Like, you can't do this without them, which is why I always say I love my men.
Why do you think that? Why do you think that is, though? Why do you think that they've been excluded? Or why do you think that the discussions, as important as they are, have not been a full 360 discussion?
Well, I think part of it is the training. So, you know, if you went through some of the feminist studies and women's studies programs that I went to, the focus was so much on women, and it could even be, what's the word, like almost militant sometimes. You know, they can be really hardcore, you know, as we see the images sometimes of the woman with her muscle up. And, you know, it's a very, very alienating approach. And I get it that, like, you know, there was a time in history when we needed to be that focused and that that aggressive about this work, but it in the longer term it hasn't worked out, right? So I right. think in a different day and age, and people are more open and more willing, and I think it's about style of education. So yeah, I mean, I have yet to meet a man who may have started, like, I've met many men who don't get it. I've met many men who said and done things that are inappropriate. I actually work with offenders who have, you know, been part of a human rights complaint or a sexual harassment complaint. I rehabilitate them. I hate that word. But I help them see what they didn't see before and make decisions from a conscious place afterwards. But I have yet to meet men that, once they take the time to be engaged and to have meaningful, honest discussions, that is not with an undertone of judging them. I've yet to meet a man that wouldn't say, you know what? Yeah, like, I'm starting to see this. So I think you don't put the work in.
I mean, that is hopeful, right?
Yeah.
That change is possible.
Yeah, it is.
Have you had negative reactions when you attempt to include men in the discussion?
Well, there's always some resistance, and this work, it has resistance is a big part of it. So when people say to me, Karen, I want to learn to do what you're doing. What skills do I need? What courses should I take? I always say, you know, it's not advertised, but a big part of what I do is active listening and conflict resolution because of the resistance in this work. And so, and like really being able to reach behind what people are saying and get to the heart of what's bothering them, right? So when I think of resistance, like it's happened everywhere, but one of the ones that makes me laugh is a top lawyer that I was working with who was very high up in his company and had said something inappropriate to a senior female staff member and ended up going through this complaints process and would not, you know, HR called me and said, this person will not see a sensitivity trainer. And so I said, well, who will they see? And they're like, well, I don't know, maybe an executive coach. So I said, okay, call it executive coaching. And we spent 10 hours together, but the reaction that I got from him in the beginning was incredible because he was really upset, more so than other people. And when I got to the root of it, he said to me, my email said, I'm seeing Karen Craigs, and that's a white woman. You're not Karen Craigs. You can't be. You're not white.
Wow.
So it was like that outright. And then after, you know, and then I said, okay, so I can explain to you why I have that name. I totally get that, you know, that's acceptable from my perspective that you might have another picture in your head, but let me explain the context for my name. And then I said, anything else? And he goes, I have three kids that are older than you, and like, what could you possibly teach me? So not only are you not white, but you're also not old enough for me to think that I can learn anything from you. And here I was, I traveled all over the world, I'd worked with ministers, I'd done all this stuff, and here was someone telling me, what the hell can I learn from you? I'm too busy for anything you have to teach me. And so, like, I think that's the most blatant example of resistance that I've had. And it was like, if I could take him on, I can take on anyone. And we totally turned it around. We turned it around. We had an amazing 10 hours together over 5 weeks. He was a great human being. And it was all about me knowing how to reach in and flip the switch.
Right, right. Wow. That's a lot of patience, I'd imagine.
It's part of the work, right? Like, I always have to remind myself, what is it, like, what am I doing this for? Often it's for the person that's resisting. Like, if I can impact that person, I'm having, like, huge change, because that person is often the gatekeeper to a lot of other people. So you have to understand social dynamics. You have to understand the tipping point theory. You have to understand, you know, how do I, like, who, if I walk into a room of people, who do I need to turn for everybody else to fall in line? Because we, as a group dynamic, we're often impacted by one or two people more than others, right? So that's kind of part of what I do, is I figure out okay, what are the issues? Who do I need to address and talk to? And once that person opens up?
Well, sure. And depending on their position and stature, they have the ability to affect 100 or even more people.
With yeah, all the time.
Right?
Yes. And they're not always the people at the top. Some people that are not at the top who have huge influence. And ultimately for me, it's about like really, like you're having all these conversations, you're talking to all these people. You're also like getting into the meat of what is this work about and what is it going to take and how do we create change and what does resistance look like and what are the stories that we need to learn from? And for me, that was what every single interaction has been about. It has been about not only making the impact there, but then taking the lessons from it and understanding, you know, what is this work about? Why do we even have these issues? Why haven't they been solved until now, right? Mm. What's it going to take?
A big question.
Yeah.
So who would a typical client be for your company?
Oh, pretty much anyone. So I've worked with government agencies who are creating policies and programs and, are not sure how to do this, or they want to update their policies, or they want to update their toolkits, or they want training for their staff. So I've worked with government agencies in Canada, in Rwanda, Senegal, Cameroon. I've also worked with the government of St. Lucia most recently. I went 3 times to St. Lucia last year. That was amazing. So governments, and then corporations, corporations like CIBC Bank. I was working with them for 9 months on how to mainstream accessibility, because they were creating a brand new building and they wanted everybody to walk in the building feeling like that building had been made with them in mind. And when think of something like accessibility, it's not often a priority and people don't know how do I go from, you know, bring your own walking chair, your walking stick or wheelchair, or your own, you know, technology to this corporation thought of me. So I help them with that process. So institutions, governments, and also NGOs and communities. So I'll work with anybody. My main thing is I don't like to do window dressing work, and I've often said no to requests to support people who are doing it for the wrong reasons, which is just check the box or hurry up and get this out of the way, because I know that I can cause more harm than good that way. So I will, you know, I will take the time to get to know what the person needs, what's going on, and then to create a specific response that's going to help them create meaningful change. But I want to work with people who really care and who want to get this right, because there's too many people who've gotten this work wrong.
Right, right. How difficult is it when you're looking at a situation to be able to determine all the moving pieces that you need to impact? And I'm just thinking through that example you gave about empowering the women with the income, but then it had this negative impact elsewhere that you weren't anticipating. Obviously that comes with experience, I'm assuming, but how do you have a process for how you make sure that you're covering off all those angles as best you can?
Yes. And so I would start by saying it does take a lot of experience, but I did start this work 20 years ago when I didn't know what I was doing. And so it is possible to introduce tools and processes and guidelines for people who are starting this work out. And I actually teach people in my online program how to learn to do this in any context that they're working in. But it does take experience and it does take a lot of learning, and we don't always get it right. And I think the goal is to do your best, but at the same time, learn from every situation. That has always been my philosophy. When I'm working with anyone, I always step back and I say, where's the value add? What have I learned that I can contribute to the practice of doing feminist empowerment work and gender equality work within the sector as a whole, and how can I teach people how to do that? But, you know, to give you a very simple answer, I talked in a video about intersectionality, which is really important for the work that we're doing. And intersectionality basically means that we recognize that we are made up of multiple identities, but more importantly, that we have distinct experiences of oppression and agency as a result of our very unique social identity. Now I'm talking technical terms, but what it comes down to is anytime I'm selling a product, designing a product or service, I have to know who are the different stakeholders that I'm trying to reach. And once I understand those different stakeholders, how are they unique in terms of what the issues are that are impacting them, what the needs are that they have, and how I can support them best. And so it's about breaking it down. Now, that's talking about the principle of equity, which means that, you know, we recognize that everybody has a different starting point and they need different things to get to the same end result. So for example, for you, let's take your t-shirts. We keep it really simple. So you have one, you know, your logo, but you know that not everybody is an XL. So you want to have different sizes. If you're looking at colors, you know that some people may be colorblind. So how can you create a product that even colorblind people can buy? You know, you're creating a website, you know that some people are not visual, they're visually impaired. So how can you help them have access to your product? So it's about, you know, at the most basic level, it's about breaking it down to that degree of thinking and then building up your process and your services and your everything you're doing to really recognize and embody all those differences and do something to make sure you're reaching everyone.
Do your clients express surprise at how complicated the discussions are? Because I'm sure most people don't go that in depth when they're doing their own planning.
Yeah, they don't. They don't. And by the time they come to me, they've figured out that it's costing them something, right? Like there's a reason why they're motivated to come and fix the process. And so, and they want to work with somebody who can keep it simple, who can hit the right things, and who can connect the right dots. And that's because I can go very deep in granular detail, but I'm also able to go very high up and look at things from a global perspective. I always find the right amount of detail and the right amount of complexity. But, you know, it sounds complex, but it really isn't. It really isn't. For example, let me give you another example. So a lot of governments collect data, right? Everything that they do, they collect data. If I was asked what's one thing I can do to do better work in the work that I'm doing in government, I would say break your data down. So you're going to go and ask people to fill a form that says, you know, what's your name and how old, you know, which age group are you in? So when right now we're used to seeing male or female, but if you want to be more intersectional and inclusive, you can ask people to break down the male, female even further, LGBTQI2S, you know, I have a ability or disability, whatever it is. And of course you have to follow the rules around privacy, but you can break it down. So you're not changing your process. You still have a form. You're still asking people to answer very similar questions. You're just collecting more specific information. And then the next part to that is then to sit down with the data and say, what is this telling me? Right?
Mm-hmm.
It sounds complicated, but it actually can be, there's two parts to this work. One is taking what you're already doing it and doing it better. And then the other part is introducing new things that would enhance what you're doing even more. And I always start with what are you already doing and how can we make it better?
And so you just mentioned the government side, and this is an oversimplistic question, but out of curiosity, if a company were looking to be more gender inclusive or equitable, what's the one area that you would recommend they start by looking at first?
That's a great question. And I have implemented this myself in an organization that I worked in for a few years. So, you know, they said to me, we want to work done, it's all amazing, but we have no budget. And I hear that all the time. The number one thing is we want to do it, but we don't have any money to do it. So I've gotten really good at looking for what can we do without adding any new resources. And the one thing everybody can do without adding any new resources is to hire a different kind of person. So creating a committee that has this lens. So maybe just one person or more than one person, maybe we train everybody on this lens. And then when they're hiring other people, they integrate questions around it. But in this one context, what we did is every time we hired somebody, whether it was a marketing professional or a finance person or a CFO, we started to ask them not only for their qualifications, but also their values and their experiences around intersectional equality issues. And we would pick people who were not only a right fit in terms of their technical capacity, but we also pick people who are a right fit in terms of how they see the world and what their values are around equality issues. And within 3 years, this was a big organization, so it did take 3 years, but within 3 years, we shifted so much just by bringing in more and more people who got it. Because training doesn't always get you there, right? Like, if you're training people who don't get it, it's going to take a lot longer and many people will not integrate the learning. But if you're bringing in people every time you're hiring a new position who get it, like your work is simple. All they need to know is how. Just show me, Karen, how do I do it in the context of my role?
Yeah. Change is hard, right?
Yeah. So being realistic, but also very simple. Start hiring people who get it.
Have you ever taken the approach of showing a business the financial benefit to enacting a change? Because, you know, as when they look at it as an expense line, what's the ROI on the investment, right? Is that an approach that you ever take? Is it even quantifiable that way? I'm sure it is, but.
Oh my gosh, it is. It so is. And there's two ways to look at it. One is to make the argument, which you can find in any report on gender, which says, look, you know, if we just pay, and by the way, it is illegal to pay women and men different amounts of money for the same job. And yet there's not one company that I've come across that is actually practicing equal pay, right? Because they won't even open their books to show you that two program officers who are both doing the same job, one is a woman, one is a man, they're not getting the same pay. Yeah. And it's not just about men and women. It's also about racialized women and racialized men. And, you know, so like there's all these layers to equal pay, just a simple issue. But if you, so, you know, the case studies that are used or the case that's made from a business perspective is, well, you know, Canada would actually benefit as an economy to have $150 billion extra in GDP if we just paid women the same as men. One action. If we paid all the women the same as we pay men in every company, we would have $150 billion more in our GDP. But how do you take that and bring it down to an organization? I would say that's a metric, there's a certain term for the economic analysis around return on investment, and they've shown it after the fact. But what I do is I show clients organizations I've worked with, and I show them where they were when I started, because they would all have income revenue. And then I show them 3 to 5 years later what their income and revenue was, and also what the non-tangible benefits were for them. So for example, with one organization, we went from about 100 million to like 500 million. And more than that, we became like the go-to organization in the sector. We started impacting national policies. An organization I worked in Africa, we started partnering with the African Union, the African Development Bank. Like, so there's reputational gain. There's influential gain you get when you do this work right, because very few people know how to do it right. And then there's the bottom line in terms of income and your ability to grow and have impact. And, you know, I mean, I don't say this enough, but that's actually what I do. What I do is I go into an organization that's decided that they want to fix this problem. And I don't just fix it for them. I actually help them stand out as leaders in the whole sector. Mm. Yeah, it's hard to put figures on it in general terms, but it's definitely possible. And there's amazing case studies that show that, you know, you benefit in so many ways that you didn't expect.
Do you ever get discouraged in your work? You sound amazingly positive.
What do you think? I live and breathe this. I love it. I've tried many times to walk away from it because it is hard sometimes to face the backlash. You know, when I was younger, the backlash would be from people I love saying, like, go get a real job. Like, why are you trying to save the world? And then when I had kids, you know, with other family saying, like, you're a bad mother because you're never here and you're always traveling. And, you know, and now these days, I have been so dedicated, like, so committed to this work that now they know, like, everybody around me just knows, let her do her thing because this is what she's here for.
It's your mission.
Yeah. Like I couldn't do anything else. I just couldn't. You know, I've tried. I really have. Like there are days when I'm like, I'll just bag groceries and make my life simple. But that's not why I'm here. And when you have a gift like this, like I want people who are listening to us to think about this. If you have a gift, you have to find a way to give that gift space to grow and to be in the world, because it's not an accident that you have that gift, right? Like I tried to walk away from this so many times. And it kept pulling me back in. And then finally, I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to do the good and the bad. And I'm going to have days where I just want to be with the kids and I don't want to be active, being an activist. And then there are days where I'm like, yep, bring it on. Let's do this.
So what's next for you and your company?
Well, I think COVID has really been an interesting challenge for everybody. And as a business owner, I have my own business now. You know, I've had to figure out how can I reach people and how can I continue to have this impact given the new world that we live in, because I'm very, very gifted in person. People love spending time with me in person, and not having that, having that dynamic possible right now has been challenging. So I've gone online. And so like many people, I'm doing a lot of webinars. In fact, a few days ago, I did a webinar for 100 people in Australia. It was really late my time, very early their time, but it was a fantastic conversation, amazing. And it just showed me that you don't have to be in a room to reach people, right? Like, it was just incredible, really moving work. And so I'm doing a lot more online. I have an online program, and I also coach people one-on-one in terms of if you work in development or you work in a specific sector, how do you stand out from everybody else? How do you articulate what's unique about you? And bring it to life. So I'm doing business coaching for influencers in that way. And the other thing that I do is also audits. So an organizational audit, normally when you say audit, people think of finance. But a lot of organizations want to know, you know, like, I'm doing this and I'm doing that, but like, what's the big picture here? What am I missing? What's the roadmap? And so I go in and I have a process that I lead them through that helps give them a bit of a scorecard for where they are. And then, you know, the distinguishes the low hanging fruit, like in the next 6 months, you could do this, this, and this. And in 2 years, you could do this, this, and this. And over time, you'll be able to, you know, get things moving and be in the right direction. So these are all things that I'm offering and finding it's stuff I've been doing, but it's about finding ways of doing it with people when I can't be there in person. And that's a process, right?
Yeah. And it's opened up a whole new world of possibility that way.
Yes, yes. You know, like, how has it impacted your work and what you're doing?
Well, I mean, it's been interesting because we launched this company in the middle of a pandemic. So, you know, obviously we're not breaking sales records, but what we are doing is this right now. We're connecting with an amazing number of people and learning lots and really kind of getting into the community that we want to be a part of and to learn from. So, you know, you could look at it negatively from a business standpoint, but that's not the approach that we're taking right now. There's a lot of positives from this, you know, being able to dedicate more time to engaging with people and building up that foundation of knowledge and support and, you know, fans, people that we're fans of and people that are fans of us. So, you know, that's been a real bonus to this time period. So, you know, you got to look for the silver linings. We're healthy and safe, so we're lucky that way, so that's we can focus on the positives.
Yeah, and I'm doing the same thing. I'm, you know, I'm engaging with people through platforms like this with you. You know, here's the thing about this work. A lot of us don't take the time to figure out what do we want, right? And then to allow the work to happen around what we actually want. And what I want is to be the number one name in this work. So when you think of Oprah, you know who she is, what her brand is, what she stands for, and how she's contributed to the world. When it comes to equality, gender equality, inclusion work, I want people to think of me in that way. So building that kind of brand at that level of being, you know, being out there, it's both. So here I am doing empowerment work, but I got to do my own internal empowerment work to say, A, that's possible, and B, you know, I can do this. And I have everything I need to make it happen. And so a lot of this time has been taken with, you know, challenging myself, you know, empowering myself to really use my voice and get out there and to be on media. Like, media is scary. You know, that's a whole other game to be on TV or radio. And you worry about, am I going to say something wrong? Are people going to judge me? Whatever. But my cause is so big and it impacts all of us. And there's no reason why, you know, we shouldn't be having this conversation at that level, right? So this is all the COVID and all of these kinds of initiatives are really helping me take the many steps up the ladder towards that.
Yeah, awesome. That's great. Karen, thank you so much. This has been an amazing hour.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for asking such great questions. And thank you for everything that you're doing to promote the cause. And I love that I'm talking to a man about this.
I know, you know, that's one of the greatest things actually, because we're really active on Instagram, and I spend a lot of the time on that and engaging with people. And it's so, I love it because so often people will reply to the comments that I leave on their posts and they refer to me as a female. And I totally get why. And then I tell them in some cases, depending on the context of the conversation, that, oh, well, I'm actually the husband of the husband and wife team. So this is who you're talking with. And it's just this great like moment where people are like, oh, okay, well, that's cool too. And it's, there's never been like a negative backlash of like, oh, you know, this should be the woman, or we thought it was a female we were speaking to, or nothing. Like, it's been so amazingly accepting and inclusive. And yeah, it's just, it's awesome. I don't know how else to say it. It's just awesome. It's fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's a great example of unconscious bias, right? That we see something about feminist empowerment and our brain just thinks woman. And so sure. I love that you're challenging it without necessarily doing a training, but you're helping people experience, oh yeah, like there was an unconscious bias there for a second. And it's totally great that we have men leading this work too, right?
Yeah, and that's interesting because when I originally, like part of what I had thought would happen was I could be, and I don't mean to sound like I'm pumping up my own tires here, but I thought, well, maybe I could like show other guys that, hey, you know, it's okay to talk about this stuff. Like, that's cool, right? But it's been interesting that I'm getting the other side of it too, with where women can see that, oh, okay, well, there's, you know, some guys get it, I guess. So I'm not explaining it very well, but it's been an enlightening process.
Yeah. Well, I think you have created an amazing path, both of you, and you as a man have created a great pathway forward for others to engage on the issue and to find ways to show that they support each other on this issue. And it's all really great. So thank you for everything that you do. And thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Karen. It was lovely to finally meet you face to face, sort of. And we'll definitely stay in touch.
Yeah. Take care. Enjoy your weekend.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Bye.